You're listening to the Movie Crew Podcast. Tonight, we talk about Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2.
You, no trouble. Me, fifth element. Supreme being.
You will be a weapon. You will be a minister of death, praying for war. But until that day, you are cute. Sound off like you got a pair.
No, yes, sir!
I was wondering what would break first. Your spirit or your money?
You get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir.
God is dead.
Satan lives.
The year is won.
Fill your hand, you son of a bitch.
The city is headed for a disaster of biblical proportion.
What do you mean, biblical?
What he means is Old Testament,
yes.
Mr. Mayor. Real wrath of God type stuff.
Dead.
Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies. Rivers and seas boiling.
40 years of darkness, earthquakes, volcanoes, the dead rising from the grave.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Welcome to the podcast, Movie Crew Podcast, Movie Makers Talking Movies. We're your hosts. I'm editor Brian Elkins. With me here tonight, Cinema Al-Ghaib, that's Fremen for cinematographer, Jared Callen.
How you doing, Brian?
I'm good.
Good.
Yeah, caffeinated, as always.
Nice.
We also have with us director of photography, Mike Griggs.
What are you guys laughing about? What's funny over there? What's going on?
I dipped my worm in water.
Well,
in front of
Blue
all
Gatorade?
Those people,
was it Blue Gatorade or was it Listerine? I couldn't tell.
Which flavor was your worm piss?
The blue flavor?
I don't think it's piss. It's like worm bile.
We'll get there.
Whatever.
We also have with us tonight writer and director Jacob Simmons.
Hello. Somebody had to say it.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for bringing Kristen into the mix.
Yeah.
Yeah, she would have been good to have here for this, because instead we have what every other podcast is, four white dudes talking about Dune.
I was just thinking that myself, yeah.
Well, the whole time, Mike, at least we got somebody who actually likes Dune. The whole time she would have been like, this movie sucks.
Oh, really? Tell me why.
Oh, yeah.
No, I think she would have been all right, because of the costumes would have gotten her through. She just would have been
There's some dope costumes.
This is boring. This is so boring.
Everything sucks except Florence Pugh's mask or like head coverings.
They're
pretty fantastic.
I was actually looking forward to listening to her talk about that. So
we'll have her send you a voicemail or something.
Because the costumes in this actually are just consistently good. So
did they mess up or change the still suits from the first movie? Because they look more clothy in this movie. And I feel like they move different. In the first movie, they felt like they were like more rubber and more, or like rigid leather.
Mm.
And this one, they felt, I don't know, clothy. You could just, you're always seeing them bend and like everybody's ducking down. And maybe that was just like, maybe that's the Fremen make. I don't know. I didn't really pick up on that.
I do feel like that would make sense since the Fremen would be sort of recycling still suits. They wouldn't necessarily be like, you know, state of the art. They're out there roughing it in the desert all the time. It would make sense that they would like modify them or something.
I would say it's the opposite because the still suits are a Fremen invention, and when they were first introduced in the first movie, they're like the lady that gives them is like, oh, this is like the Fremen way of doing it. Like, how'd you figure it out?
Oh,
like that. Like,
you're right.
All that stuff.
And I'm sure the book like has a really super detailed answer to that question. I just can't remember it.
Where it's just the second one and they got a bigger budget and they fucking redesigned the ship because the first ones didn't move properly and they were like, we can't be fighting and doing all this shit and stuff that's not breathable and bendable, so we got to redesign.
There you go.
I'm inclined to think it's more that kind of thing because everybody's in still suits for like 90% of this movie. So, of course, they're going to make it a little bit more workable and comfortable and usable on an everyday set kind of situation instead of just like those four scenes or whatever.
Star Trek uniforms and Power Ranger uniforms change every movie, guys. So let's just get used to it.
That's true.
These actors should have suffered for their art just a little bit more. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, if the irony of the still suit is supposed to like keep you alive in the desert, but like us actual humans on actual Earth making these things, it's probably like hot and sweaty and they're like living in it. Like they probably legit had to change it so that it would be more safe shooting in the actual desert as much as they did.
I think they wear those things in their nose so they don't have to smell each other's BO when they're in the desert with all that shit that they're wearing. Because you know they're sweating.
No, man, the suit locks your juices in, dude. So you can drink your juices later.
Yeah, everybody when they take a, they, you know, in that sex scene, they should have showed everybody like very pruny. Like, you know, just from like the, you know, the sealed from the neck down, everybody's
I'm not
like
even
a fucking raisin.
Up yet.
Johnny's like, I love the texture of your skin. Wadib.
Fucking something's wrong with you, man. Fucking prude.
He goes ribbed for your pleasure. So,
oh, yeah, no. No.
What a way to start.
This is what happens when Chris is not present.
Well, look, no, man. Like, everybody else is talking about the shit about Dune. We've all heard the same fucking opinions on this movie, but let's talk about the real shit, you know?
Dune 2, Chicks at Once. Took you a second, huh?
Yeah, it did.
I love that. I think that's great. Yeah.
You just threw it out there, Griggs, with such confidence.
Taking big swings right off the bat.
Oh, fuck. I need to breathe.
How do you think they breathe under the sand? And how do they pop out of the sand in those scenes where they like just appear?
Well, they show you how they breathe under the sand. They show you those little apparatuses, the little
I know, but
black
how
tubes?
Do they travel under the sand? Can they like
it does
move
look
like
they're traveling
worms?
Under the sand, yeah.
Because they pop it out of like really interesting spots. Like, how do they do that?
I mean, I had always assumed that they were just under the sand for that fucking long, like
they're just hanging
waiting
out.
And shit. But yeah, when I was rewatching it again, the second one, rewatching mm-hmm. it again today, when they're doing the big final battle against the Emperor, and like Paul and all of his people jump up out of the sand, like they were clearly not there because the last time we saw him, he was standing on the cliff face with like, you know, 10,000 motherfuckers down below him or whatever, and now all of a sudden they're just popping up under the sand, like so clearly they are moving somehow. I guess. I don't know.
Maybe they can sand crawl or something. I don't know.
They sand crawl out there to bury themselves.
Yeah.
They're just like, we're going to wait for the perfect time to pop up.
Well, there's a whole thing, you know, like sandworms travel deeper. So that as long as you're like, you know, under the first 2 or 3 feet of sand, then, you know, you have to like sand slither so you don't bring up the sandworms.
What's the sand walking dance for the slithering part?
Yeah, I mean, they're smart with the things they're not showing you, right? Like, we never see anybody get off a worm. Because that would look stupid, right? All right, there's no way. There's no
I
way.
Think you do a backflip and then land in a Marvel stance. And
that's how dumb
superhero
it was.
Landing. You did a superhero landing,
and he goes. And you never see mom, right? You never see her in her little tent. You never see that get placed on a sandworm or off.
Yeah, how do you build a fire or a tent on the back of a sandworm? You know. Mm.
That was like a basket thing. Like they showed that, like sitting on the ground waiting for her to get into it. That's like her just being carried.
Maybe they drag it behind like a sled and then they reel her in.
You just have like 6 people holding on, one hand on that and one hand on the worm. Like tilt.
Yep. See, this is exactly why they did not show it.
Exactly. Yeah. Nobody needs that. They're on there. It happens. We get it.
Denis has said that he actually like did have a sort of like technique for getting off of the sandworm. He just didn't have a reason to put it in the movie.
Okay.
Look,
I also have a girlfriend. She's in Canada right now, but
that's
know,
yeah, that's
exists.
Exactly how it feels. Yeah,
you don't have a girlfriend.
Maybe in the next one. Who knows?
So I know this movie's getting a lot of love, right?
Oh, here we go.
It's the biggest box office.
Start with shitting on it. You're just gonna...
No, look, I'm not gonna start with shitting on it. I'm just gonna start with like. I know this is unfair, but going in to see the second part, man, a little bit of that magic was lost. You know, just after seeing Dune Part 1, this movie lost a little bit of the magic. The introductions to the world and how, like, every character in that first part. Like whenever you're introduced, like when you're introduced to the Bene Gesserit, we get this huge, long, big, wide shot, and they're coming out, and we're seeing like mist, and we're seeing this like floating light, and we're like, "What the fuck is that thing?" You know, and you hear the music, and everybody's got like this different musical introduction. Even like the Herald of the Change, you know, when they're coming out to meet Oscar Isaacs, and you know, he's like, "Smile, Gertie, I am smiling." You know, we have that moment. These are good, big paced, wide shot. This movie is missing that. And when I was going through and watching it tonight, like all the character introductions are super tight. We start really close this time. I missed that from the first film so much.
Well, that's interesting that you're saying that, because what I was paying more attention to the second time around, because it fucking hit me so much on this one, on the first time around, was the sense of scope and scale in this one feels bigger than the last one. But they're doing it in a different way. It's like compressed shots. So there's so many like super long lens. Like when Paul is going to jump on the worm, and he's like on that ridgeline, and you're looking across the thing, and you see the worm sign coming up over it, and then like they do this like 40-foot dolly, and then you reveal, you're like, all right, we're like, you know, pretty far away, I guess, and then you reveal him head to toe inside the frame with still more headroom. Like there's so many shots like that where you're establishing compressed frame, here's the physical distance, here's the parameters of how big it is, and then they use that later to show like when he's on the worm, like they still have that same kind of framing of like head to toe inside the frame, he's tiny, look how fucking massive this thing is, we've seen far away how big it is, now we're seeing up close and you only see this tiny little sliver. Like they're doing scope in a different kind of concentrated way, because it's a little bit more of an intimate story than the first one, I think.
Yeah, but I don't think you're supposed to really like analyze it like that, because if you think about that scene, everybody's standing on the side of a hill and they're watching, you know, Paul like ride this fucking giant worm, and it takes him a long ass time to get the hold of it. So is the worm out there doing circles? How are they still? He should be fucking like 10 miles away by that point.
What? No, Jared,
this
come on.
This worm is massive.
This is compressed time and fucking edit. This is film editing. You know, come on.
They're not. They should be running along the top of the sand dunes trying to keep up, you know, or calling other worms to catch up to
the
granddad worm.
Big.
Yeah, they're just real long.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I do love that in that shot, though. You can see him tiny in the distance. Like,
well, it's like in the first one, he screams out to the other guy. He's like, hey! Like, the motherfucker can hear him riding that worm.
Oh, man.
Well, he does it in this movie.
Everybody can hear everything in this movie. Everybody has fucking, like, super hearing. Like, you can be in a giant cavern with 3 million people, and motherfuckers can whisper, and everybody's like, oh, yeah, no, totally. It's exactly what I was thinking. You're like, what?
It's like the Grand Canyon echoes across, you know. Yeah.
I do get what you're saying, Brian, about sort of like smaller character introductions, because like some of the most important characters that we meet in this movie, we meet them like in confined interiors, you know? So just in terms of like what we're seeing in the frame for each major character introduction, like Fade Rotha, we meet him in the sort of like green room for his like tournament thing. Right.
Yeah.
And the princess, we meet the princess in her bedroom, and the emperor, we meet him in this like little confined room, with the princess and the Reverend Mother. Even, Lady Fenring, Leah Sudoz, is that the name? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Her character. We meet her character in a close-up. You know, like, I think, like, 90% of her coverage in that first scene where she's watching Fade and at the tournament, or at the Coliseum bit, like, her coverage is just, like, close-ups and medium close-ups. So, as far as, like, character introductions go, I totally get what you're saying about sort of, like, not giving us big, wide spectacle shots for our first looks on these people.
But those spectacles are definitely still in there. Like,
oh, they are. Yeah.
Talking about the tournament in the first place, like we're meeting these people in an intimate environment to show that as massive as this universe is, they are still like in their own little tiny worlds. Like what they are seeing in front of them is what they are focused on and what they care about. But there's, instead of a giant to a small close up, we start on close and then we see everything bigger. Seeing Fade Rotha in the whole like arena situation tells you a lot about his character.
Oh yeah, I think that character introduction is one of the best parts of the movie. Like the idea of this guy who, you know, what he would consider to be a rewarding and satisfying birthday present is the opportunity to like kill someone for more than just show. Like that's incredible. So that tells us so much with so little.
Yeah, but I don't know, the worm riding scene. The gladiator battle, And I guess like I guess the first scene where they're like kind of like floating up the hills and the Harkonnen soldier henchmen guys get taken out by like sniper rifles and fall down, right? Those are the three set pieces though in the movie that feel the most like the first film.
Hmm.
Those are the moments where like I am on board and I'm like, okay, you know what? I'm getting the weird thing. You know, like the thing I like the most about the sand riding worm part or whatever, the fucking sandworm where he's writing it, is when he's lifting the flat up and you see the whatever those holes are, you know,
nostrils.
Those
holes?
Are his nostrils.
Yeah, like what?
Yeah, that's
something.
What is that
for? That's how they keep
the worm blowhole.
That's how they keep the worms above. That's how they keep the worms above the sand. That's how they keep the
food diving. Yeah, but like, what is that? Is that how the worm moves? Is that just like a air pocket? I don't know. But you know what? I got how it works just from you showing me, and I'm good. It's like some sci-fi weird shit, and it's like, yeah, this rocks and roll. I get it. I'm good. But
and that's consistent with like the way that this movie does, or the way that like Dune as a part one and part two both do visual exposition like incredibly well. Like the introduction of the shields in the first movie, you know, they don't like say this is a shield and like this is how it works. They just show you this is following suit. Like, and this is another step in that same pattern. And I think that was like incredibly wise, not just for time, but also for, I mean, how dense this movie is with what it has to convey. It's just a really efficient way to get us there in a way that like feels really satisfying. I mean, that's just another thing to love.
I was trying to make sense of it, though, because if you have a creature that's that big, and it seems fairly easy to pull those fucking flaps back, so they must be like ears or something. You know, like, you know how you can grab your ear and just move it? We're massive, but, you know, something small could move our ears around. You think those flaps are kind of like...
I think more like skin cells, Jared. Do you see how big that fucking worm was?
That's what I'm saying. They're so massive. Yeah, like, how are you pulling their gills open like that?
Again, I'm sure that's something that the book has an answer for. That
I doubt it.
It's just slipping my mind.
It just happens. It's suspension of disbelief, bro.
Yeah, you don't need it, though. Like, if that's what you're focused on, then, like, the storytelling of the rest of the plot is just too poor to actually matter.
These are only things I think of after I've seen it multiple times. I'm like, how is he able to pull that back? Mm-hmm. He's got great aim with those hooks, too. I want you to miss with, like, get one and, like, miss, and then fucking one falls off. You're like, oh, shit.
No, that'll happen in the next one.
Oh, I know. I'm just
like,
saying.
He was, like, falling down that, it did look like he was falling down, but I guess he was getting, like, swept on the back.
Swept onto it, like you're talking about when he first goes down the big dune.
Yeah.
Well, then the worm starts like busting through dunes, you know, trying to knock him off.
Yeah.
Yeah. The
it's
only
a pretty
part
spectacular sequence
I didn't like of the hooks is when he throws them out, and it kind of looks like they just eject and they shoot out like a Batman grappling hook. But at the same time, they also have like a weightless like. I don't know, like it is like a
the physics of it isn't as heavy as it looks like it should be.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. Thank you.
Especially when you're going through a fucking sandstorm on the back of a sandworm.
I'm glad that these are the things that we like have to point out and be like, ah, that doesn't work. You know, like the most minuscule. Like,
yeah. Look, hey, I know we're talking shit, it's not really. It's just the minutia. The fucking movie is amazing. It's shot amazing. The fucking acting, the score, all of it's great. So yeah, you just gotta like, this is kind of weird, right?
And it is, yeah. But I'm happy that we're getting a movie that's so good that in finding the things to pick apart and be like, that doesn't really make any sense. You know, it's like one or two shots in one of the most impressive sequences that I've seen in the last couple of years. I like, you know, everyone looks forward to when you hear they're making a Dune movie. They're like, oh, okay, great. We're going to see the sandworm writing or whatever. That's like one of the big things that people, especially people who've read the book, like we're looking forward to. And I was not convinced that they were going to pull it off. And the fact that I was sitting in the theater, like watching it on the big screen, getting blown away in real time, the fact that they pulled that off and like got a response and it felt good. You know,
what are you talking about? You saw it in the first one, and then you can even hear Timothy Chalamet underneath it go, "Desert power."
I'm talking about up close, like watching the sand dune collapse and him just kind of getting swept into it like water. You know, you think he's going to drown in sand for a couple seconds. That like amazing low shot of his he's on the ball of his foot, like lifting his heel off the worm. The music kicks in like that. You feel something there.
Yeah. I think your feeling is the reaction from everybody that's watching him. Like those Spielberg crowd reaction shots in that moment.
Oh, they're fucking
glorious. Yeah, fucking Harvey R. Yeah. is just knocking it out of the park, man. You know, his reactions are so good in that scene. Like, that's that's what's all the... Maybe him and Rebecca Ferguson are the fucking heart of the movie. They carry everything, I think.
He's like the true believer, you know. He's making it happen.
Oh. He's so funny, too, man. I did not expect that.
I like when she's like, I doesn't want to become the Reverend Mother, and he's like, well, then...
There's not much else to do at this point.
I'll fucking kill you.
We'll return your
water to the well.
Which started making me think, if you have, like, the voice... And, like, even at the end and in the fucking, like, battle, why didn't fucking, like, dude just say, kneel to me, you know, and, like, fucking, like, make fucking Fade, like, go down on his knees and then stab him in his throat? Like, use the voice, motherfuckers.
Let's talk about that. I think that is one of the more redeeming qualities of Paul as a male person in a patriarchal system. Taking over the women's role of the Bene Gesserits. Like, most of the Bene Gesserits, when they're using the voice, they are taking agency away from the people they're using the voices on. And most of the time, there is appropriately justifiable reasons. Like, in the first one, when we see him, like, in the ornithopter, and she's like, tell your friend to kill the other one, or all that shit.
Yeah.
Most of the time in this movie, people are... their choice is being removed. And so Paul is... not doing that, except for when people are getting in his way. Like, he tells the Reverend Mother silence or whatever when she's trying to pipe up and interrupt him, but, like, that's the extent of it. He's not taking her agency away. He's removing her ability to take someone else's agency away. I don't know if that's a thing that was conscious or that they're going to explore more in the next one, but that's a thing that I noticed about it. Maybe that's just me projecting.
Maybe he wants to win in a fair fight, I guess.
Yeah, I also think, it's like ritual combat. Like, that's political. It's actually, like, in the larger Dune universe, there are only so many appropriate ways to wage war. It's like part of the sort of pacts that all of the houses agree to, like intergalactic law, whatever. Trial by combat is like a valid way to wage, one of the few valid ways to wage war, on a large scale. You would just have a basic gladiatorial match. And I think Paul using the voice in that match probably would have, like, invalidated it, you know?
Well, I mean, not only that, but at this point he can see all fucking versions of the fucking future. So he knows the way he's going is the way... this is what he has to do.
Yeah.
So Jared, just trust him, all right?
Okay.
He's the chosen one.
How did he survive a fucking, you know, 12-inch blade into the fucking stomach like that, into his lungs?
Okay.
The same way Rebecca Ferguson survived drinking the worm poison or whatever, they can control their bodies on a cellular level. He can basically stop the bleeding just with, like, by thinking real hard.
How do you know that?
I don't know about that. They didn't show us any Wolverine healing abilities or anything in the movie.
No. He's
not a fucking Jedi, bro. Yeah. Paul can't fucking bring people back like that.
Yeah. Paul says to when they're all like, "Oh, she lived. It's a miracle."
He says her body can process the poison, not that it can heal itself and repair damage.
Well, no. I didn't say it was about repairing damage.
Well,
I said
we're talking
that it's
about a knife fight.
No. He can keep himself from bleeding out.
I don't know. I don't know, man.
I mean, that's
don't
in
bring
the...
some book bullshit. We didn't read the book.
Yeah. No. That's
all we're going off with. The fucking...
This ain't no book club.
They didn't show anything.
It's in the text of the movie that people with Bene Gesserit training can decide the sex of their babies and, you know, keep poison from killing them on a cellular level. So, like, saying, "Oh, this guy can restrict his blood vessels at will to keep himself from bleeding out" is not breaking the world. It's not a stretch.
I don't know. That seems like some stretch shit, bro. You know? Like, I need to see a Bene Gesserit, like, stabbed and, like, her, you know, and then she lives, and then I can understand that. Because I've seen so many people stabbed in this fucking movie and they just drop dead.
Well, they don't have Bene Gesserit training.
I mean, obviously. But, like, I need to know that. If you don't tell me that, like, I'm not a Bene Gesserit. I don't know that. Communication via visuals. Were they trying to say that, like, he's, like, supernatural now?
Technically he is, I guess.
I mean, maybe, or... Sorry, go ahead.
If he could see throughout all time and space and know everyone's fucking, like, thoughts and like, all their, you know, dreams and everything, maybe he is. He is a superhero.
He's just...
He's a god.
His brain is basically a computer to the extent that he can take information and infer the future and infer all possible futures based on a data set. And
man, they haven't
the
even established that Paul Atreides is a Mentat in this fucking Dune universe. So,
What's a Mentat?
Those are the people that can calculate shit like that. So, like, what he says in the movie and the way he's, like, moving his hand is, like, he can literally see, like, all these. There's no, like, scientific, I can calculate any of this in the movie. He's, like, Denis Villeneuve is literally showing you his hand like it's in a stream. Like, he's doing, like, a little fish motion with his hand.
I mean, okay, well, this isn't, this isn't book club, but that just is, that is how it. The character works in the novel. Whether or not that's, you know, portrayed adequately in the film to get that point across is another thing. But because, like, that's what the Bene Gesserits have been trying to breed this whole time, is, like, the human who is more than human, because he can basically calculate the future. He can, through genetic memory, extrapolate a data set into a reliable picture of the future. And therefore, like,
in this movie, though, they haven't even told us what the Bene Gesserit want from the Quasar Haderach, other than, like, it is a supreme being and that I guess they'll be able to control it.
Yeah.
But yeah, what they want from that, we have no idea. They've not told us in this movie series. Maybe that's what the HBO show is going to be about. I have no idea. What is that called? Dune Prophecy or some shit?
Yeah, Prophecy.
HBO show.
You guys seen the trailer for that?
No.
It looks okay.
Yeah. It looks like Mentat Erasure is what it looks like.
Is it in this universe, or is it a parallel thing?
Yeah, it looks like a... Was it a prequel series? Anybody know more about this? I just saw the trailer. That's it.
All right.
I'm sure that because it's all under the, you know, Warner Brothers umbrella, they'll try to consider it part of, like, a... You know, it's franchising.
They have the same costumes. The same floating lights. Cool. You know, lights still float the same.
But I think it's, I mean, I think it's safe to assume that the Bene Gesserit just want a incredibly powerful figurehead that they can sort of puppet, because, you know, they're pursuing all the different bloodlines, and they're talking, when they're talking about Fade, you know, he's also part of that genetic breeding program. He just isn't as far along as Paul. You know, that's why they have Fenrir go and secure the bloodline and everything, because he's still incredibly valuable to them. But they, when they talk about him, they're talking about looking for a leader who they can control, and who they can control better than Shaddam the Fourth, like Christopher Walken's Emperor. You know, he doesn't have any of these abilities or powers.
But again, we don't know what the intent is behind that. All we know is that it's this nefarious group of people that are, like, doing some shit, and we don't know why or what their end goals or hopes or aspirations are. I guess they don't have hopes. They just plan.
Yeah, and I don't think you can use the book to go off things, because this installment changes quite a lot from the book.
It does. It does.
But Chani's character is completely different. How
for the better.
I keep wanting to call him the Harkins. No, that is what they're called in this one, is the Harkins.
Yeah, that's what they're called. Harkins.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. There we go. I had it right. But yeah, how he dies is totally different.
Everybody's a Harkin.
Yeah, well, I think that's accurate.
So it seems like the Bene Gesserits are actually just playing in that. Are there other... They have Fade and they have fucking Paul. And they're
she
both...
She says several
Arcanans.
Times we have many prospects,
yeah, but
or some shit.
Who yeah. else is it? You know,
Is other great families? I don't know.
Yeah, we haven't even been off Dune in this movie.
No, we're on the Harkonnen homeworld.
Yeah, you got a scene there. But we've
two
had
or
that.
Three scenes there.
What's the only new place is like the... Whatever planet the Emperor's on? Did they even name it? In the movie?
No.
His, like, little garden area? The weird.
Yeah, I don't think we do get a name
windows.
For that.
I do like that set. It's really pretty.
That's actually not a set. That's a straight-up location.
Oh, that's
really?
Even more dope.
Yeah.
No wonder they have such interesting angles there.
And they barely did any set deck to it.
I love
Amazing.
That.
Amazing.
Right? Yeah.
I tell you what's a set is the fucking Harkonnen fucking, like, battlefield. That damn triangle with all the crazy, like, massive crowds.
Dude,
has
I
to
love
be, like,
that.
It had to be only, like, a little piece of that was real. The rest of it has to be all just massively fake.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it looks
It looks
dope.
Great. Especially in that weird, glowy black and white.
Dude.
Especially how they kind of transfer from color into that as they walk out into the light.
Yep. Really, and then you got a couple more little things where they're just throwing some color out to make sure your eye knows that this is not black and white. This is what the world looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
fucking love it.
Yeah, the first time I saw it, that was fucking with me when we were like, "Wait, the last scene was color. Why are we black and white? What's going on?" And you get that nice dolly shot.
It shows you. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is nice.
What a great fucking introduction. It's so brilliant. And then I love how, like, the fireworks looking things, like the liquidy fireworks.
Oh, what is that? Do they have, like, a dome over there and people are attacking them? Because they show a wide shot later and there's things coming up and hitting.
It's fireworks.
Is it? Yeah, because they're celebrating his what day?
His birthday.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
His birthday.
But, like, later when he's walking in the tunnel at night, like, the fireworks have color. And you can actually see it when it's, you know, the sun isn't taking all the color out of everything. And they do that with all the stuff on their home world. It's really fucking interesting.
You know what? Well, on that note, we're going to take a break. We're going to play the trailer for Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2. Or Part Dose or Part Due or, you know, whatever. 2. We'll be back.
It's breathtaking. When you see sand here, imagine water. If you dive in, you can't reach the bottom.
You dive in.
Yes, it's called swimming.
I don't believe you.
In the shadows of Arrakis lie many secrets. But the darkest of them all may remain. The end of House Atreides.
Your father didn't believe in revenge.
What if Paul Atreides were still alive?
Have you ever had a dream about your first ride?
Don't try to impress anyone. You're brave, we all know that. Be simple. Be direct. Nothing fancy.
I understand. Nothing fancy.
You will never lose me, Paul Atreides.
We gave them something to hope for.
That's not hope!
May thy knife chip and shatter.
All right, we're back. That was a trailer for Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2. What a good trailer, and look at that fucking cast list.
They gave it all away, didn't they, Mike? They had the sandworm ride, the kiss, the black and white scene, fucking even the I hope your blade chips
and shatters.
Yeah, but that was from the first movie, though. You know, it's a good callback, man.
It's a good trailer, but it definitely there's I don't know. I'll say this is one of the better ones that I've seen actually in the last decade of as far as giving tone and a sense of style and intrigue. I do think they give the entire worm riding scene away.
Yeah, the whole thing. Even everybody like,
several of the shots that we like just talked about, like the reaction shots and stuff like that, were in that trailer.
Oh, the whole fucking scene is in the trailer. But
yeah,
like,
it's just condensed,
if you're gonna build a trailer around a scene, like that's a really good way to do it. They've condensed it. You get the tone. You get the style. You get the substance of it. Without feeling like you're missing anything, but knowing what the movie actually gives you in that, like it builds really well.
It's an expected thing. We know that there's going to be sandworm riding. It's kind of like a Game of Thrones. Like we need to see somebody riding a dragon. You know,
damn exactly. Straight. Don't be holding back. Come on.
Yeah.
Give me a little Flavor Flav before I go see the movie. No, I support this. I support this. It did remind me, like, I did like some of the sound effects and the weapons. Whatever that fucking, like, minigun that they were shooting out of the side of the fucking ornithopter.
That little salt cannon bullshit.
God, like, man, it sounded so cool, though. It didn't look cool, but, like, it just looked like, you know, nothing. Yeah. You know, you just saw the impact on the sound, but the sound was fucking great.
Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. I mean, when Paul and Chani are tag-teaming that ornithopter and he sort of throws himself out there as bait, like, that does so much for their relationship, I think.
Well, that's the first time she kind of trusts him as much as she's probably gonna trust him.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, the romance stuff did seem a little summer blockbuster. We're skipping some character beats, but, you know, I get it. Like, you have so much story to tell. There's so much fucking plot to get through.
And talking about changes character from beats. The book, like, that sequence, the whole second act of that movie in the novel is, like, 4 years long. But because they didn't want to introduce the talking infant, they had to keep it within the 9 months of Jessica's pregnancy. So a lot of that did get condensed, and you do feel it.
I do like her talking to unborn child.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, there's some really good comic relief there.
When she's like, quiet.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay, she's still the mom. Got it. She might be an all-seeing baby who can speak from the womb, but she's still got a mom.
Anna Taylor-Joy coming in for her, like, what, three shots, fucking, maybe?
No, she's in one shot.
Were that many? It was one shot.
No, there's some of the back of her head. I don't know if that's her. That could have been a stand-in.
That's probably not her, bro.
Yeah, I know, but it's supposed to be, you know, because what are you supposed to think that is? You're supposed to think that's Rebecca Ferguson's character that's coming out in the beach?
No, because she turns around and you see her face, though.
Yeah, eventually, yeah. But
I'm not talking about Anya Taylor-Joy. I'm talking about Rebecca Ferguson's face.
What about her face?
You're talking about the behind the walking behind the shots and
that's
the visions.
That's a different dream sequence, though.
Oh, yeah,
that's because that one at the end, you kind of like you're thinking it's going to be Rebecca Ferguson again.
Yeah, but it's sister.
And I didn't.
Right.
Speaking of the dream sequence, I didn't understand the whole Shawnee looking like she was like radiated.
Because radiation sickness. She was worried because they have fucking nuclear weapons, and so that was her vision of that.
No, like, that was his nightmare.
That was his vision?
That was his fear. That's what he's going to do in using the nuclear weapons. Yeah. He's going to kill the woman he loves.
But that wasn't like brought up or discussed, and like nothing happened with that at the end? Like, I don't know. That was so weird.
Well, no, like he wakes up from that dream and then literally has it happen in front of them. There are bombs going off, and she is on the top of a hill, and he goes up and grabs her. That's why he's looking at her face like,
right.
You're not
he
melted,
goes and
right?
Checks her out.
Like,
but then they also blow up a fucking town or whatever, or that area, and was those not nukes that they sent in? Those are just standard missiles.
No,
they were nukes.
They don't say they're not inside.
They send in three. You know, you got the fucking Emperor's fucking ship or whatever, and they send the three fucking missiles.
Those are
in.
Nukes. Yes,
really? They didn't have mushroom cloud though, but they were. It was a big explosion.
Oh, you know that's true. I didn't even think about that. It was a big explosion, but it was not a mushroom cloud
because every time they showed
that's a good
point.
That's a good point. Maybe they just blew up the fucking mountain. Without a nuke.
Okay, that's weird now. So, like, are they not, like, radioactive? They got, like, some kind of, like, space spice explosion going on there? But that's weird. Like, he's, like, maybe... So was his dream with Chani, was that not... Was I misreading that? Was that not, like, her being burned by, like, having radiation burns?
In that vision, there was a fucking mushroom cloud.
I think the point of that vision was just to say that if Paul uses the nukes...
It's going to kill her.
Well, not necessarily even kill her. It's just that he's going to lose her, which he does.
I don't know. I don't think he does because, like, he even says in the movie, like, oh, no, she'll come around. When she walks out and the mom's like, I'm sorry about Shawnee. He's like, no, she'll come around. Like,
well,
he knows
books,
what's going to go on.
He tells her that I'll, you know, he tells Florence Pugh's character, I'll marry you, but I will not have kids with you. He has kids with you know, someday.
Right.
Hmm. Oh yeah,
but
in the book.
In the books, yeah.
I think the only reading on the whole like nuclear, you know, burns on Chani thing is just sort of. I think the way that makes sense is just if it's more general than, oh, if you use the nukes, Chani's going to get like caught in the crossfire or something and get radiation burns or whatever. I mean, because that like you said, Brian, that doesn't ever get any sort of acknowledgement later on. I have to take that as more. Broad.
The dream sequences are just that. They're dream sequences. They're
right.
They're shadows of visions that they're ambiguous, they're vague because he is supposed to be feeling these more than he's like seeing them directly. And so that's the whole point of it is that it's visualizing his fear. It's showing us, it's externalizing his emotions. And then when he wakes up and sees the exact same thing happen in the dream, it like solidifies that he is able to actually see a version of the future for us. So like that happens several times throughout the movie before he takes the worm poison.
Yeah, maybe she just should have been on fire or something instead, and not like, you know, radiation burn. I don't know. Yeah, because it is a striking image. She turns around, you're like, oh damn, fuck.
Yeah,
she's such a beautiful woman, you know, like it, yeah, make her look all fallout
skin
gross.
Melty.
Yeah,
fallout gross. Yeah,
fallout gross.
And I am glad that is the way that Denis chose to include the vision sequences. He said himself in interviews and stuff that, like, in a perfect world, the vision sequences don't even make it in the movie, but they kind of have to be there to convey certain necessary pieces of information. Like, he really uses one well when Paul realizes that his mother is the one leading the way to the jihad, to the genocide.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's great. But, I mean, but that again, is sort of just, like, slowly revealing sort of the spirit of the truth, and not necessarily like the explicit, oh, this image that you're seeing right now is what's going to happen in the future. I mean, because the first movie does that too. The first movie has he has a vision, a very like vague vision of Chani stabbing him, you know?
Yeah.
And that doesn't come to pass, but that does sort of embody a potential negative outcome, you know, something that influences his decision making going forward.
Well, one of the things I really love about this movie is the way that with two movies dealing with so much like visions and feelings and all these dream sequences, they have some recurring visuals that like help to solidify those things and to actually confuse you and make it a little bit more ambiguous. Like, I love that it looks most of the time like the person that's walking away is Chani, but then you discover it's Rebecca Ferguson. Like, those kinds of things play really well. But there's also like the dream sequence from the first one where he sees the sweeping across the galaxy and the fighting things, and like there are lots of recurring shots in this one that are calling back to that. Like, there's one scene where when they're fighting the Emperor, you're watching Chani run through and kill all these motherfuckers. It's exactly like what Paul did in the first one, and then like they have that same like finally get closer and she lands and turns around like right into the frame, exactly like Paul did in the first one. And there's lots of those kinds of recurring things where it's just so well crafted of planning out these things lead to those things, and that implies this thing over here, and you can just remember it based on how the frame is and who's in the frame and who we're looking at in those moments. It's fucking brilliant, man.
Yeah, and as the movie progresses and as Paul progresses on his journey, the visions like tighten up and get more and more specific and more and more accurate. Yeah, that is really satisfying to see play out from beginning to end. So when are we going to talk about Christopher Walken?
Look, Christopher Walken is an Academy Award winning actor. I like him a lot. I respect the man. I don't even want to talk about him in this movie.
He was the most surprising casting choice. I was like, oh, okay, so it's Christopher Walken. Cool. Not like, who's going to be this interesting person that's going to tell me a lot about this character? No, it's Christopher Walken. Cool. Okay.
Guys, watch all of his scenes again. Literally, Denis Villeneuve is cutting around Christopher Walken, especially at the fucking end sequence. Like, when Stellan Skarsgård comes in there and they, like, fucking cut his cords to his little ball thing and they hit him in the back of the neck and he falls down. The last big lines where, like, Christopher Walken's like, where's Paul Mahdib, or where's Mahdib Gharibu? I want him here. Find him. Not even on fucking camera. Stellan Skarsgård reaction holds that whole fucking thing. Mm. What is going on here? Did like Denis Villeneuve like cast him, and then he was like, oh shit, I was doing so good and I fucked this one up.
He was still doing his peculiar, like, you know, line readings, pausing halfway through, going up on things.
They cut around him though.
Yeah.
They cut around a lot of the pauses, man.
I think his casting, like, I mean, obviously it's very distracting because you can never not see Christopher Walken in a movie with Christopher Walken in it. But I think his casting sort of like was kind of interesting for that character, because you hear about like how big and powerful and significant the Emperor is, and then he's Christopher Walken hobbling around, you know. I think this is more about the writing than it is his casting specifically, but he really enhances this scene, I think, when the Reverend Mother, the Emperor, and the Princess are all trying to decide what to do about Muad'Dib. And he just comes up with these horrible ideas that the Princess immediately corrects. I think the fact that it's that the Emperor was cast as someone who kind of comes across as feeble and not intimidating, I think that actually like enhances that dialogue, even though it is kind of distracting to see his mannerisms and stuff, period.
I didn't even read that scene that way. I read that as him testing his daughter.
Yeah, I also saw it that way.
Yeah, I didn't read that as him being like dumb and not knowing what to do. He's trying to figure out like, daughter, are you going to be a good ruler? And he was kind of like giving her a test. And like, because the way the Reverend Mother responds, and then Christopher Walken's response at the end, you know, it's just seems like a dad very proud of his child.
I mean, he's certainly proud of her at the end, but I personally read that as sort of like he's losing his grip on power. And the decision to aid House Harkonnen in basically annihilating House Atreides, like these are not like all the changing of hands and all that stuff again and again, and all the the shady backwards politics and stuff. Like these are not the moves of someone who is confidently in power and who is like content with their seat of power. So I sort of like combined all of these other like little tidbits of information and put it together as this guy is kind of losing his way. He's slipping. And I think Christopher Walken is like a better choice than, you know, some other more, what's a good word for that? Forceful actors.
I don't know. I didn't read Christopher Walken that way, man. I didn't read him as like being a feeble emperor or anything like that. He was just trying to like be more political. And I don't know, like he's using the Harkonnens to do the bad shit, right? And like his daughter, he doesn't say his daughter's the one that's like, oh yeah, my dad loved Duke Leto like a fucking son. Really? Is that what you do to your fucking children? Honey, you should run. Florence Pugh, please get out of there with your fucking weird ass armor shit in your face. Like you should totally get out of there if that's what you fucking think. Like I don't know.
But power comes first. You know he lives.
Yeah,
in the
I mean like
power.
That's what they say. It just feels like a politician bullshit. Like because when we're seeing her say that, she's also recording it down. You know, for like all time. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. It feels like bullshit.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah.
Just like her whole fucking intro in the beginning, her setup is just like, oh yeah, this is political bullcrap. You're trying to save face and not get taken out by the other houses or whatever they're doing.
Yeah, but as a narrative device to recap the first movie and set up the second one, it does a pretty effective job. While also introducing a character. She's not a major character, but she is a pretty big player in where they're, you know, trying to go with it.
I do like how in this one, like, you get that little bit of setup, but, like, this one just kind of does pick up right where the last one left off.
Which is great.
Yeah, they're still dragging super the great body through the desert. I loved that.
Yeah, when they take him back to the siege and Javier Bardem just, like, offhandedly, like, oh, yeah, by the way, siege Dublin. That whole scene was a really interesting set. It was a really interesting location. Like, man, the sets in this fucking movie are so cool. But the well of souls or whatever they fucking call it, like the water. He said, what did he say? 38 million deciliters?
Yeah, something like that. It was deciliters, yeah.
That's a lot of souls.
It's like, damn, how many liters or gallons of water in the human body? How many people
like,
is that?
Let's do some quick math. Like,
this sounds like a lot.
But like, fuck, does it just never evaporate on this planet? Like... Do they just have like a completely sealed room? Everybody's like, shut the door.
Yeah,
you're gonna let grandma out.
They didn't bring that up. You're letting grandma out.
Well,
she was
trained,
the Reverend Mother for 5 years ago.
They trained the baby sandworms. They like pull them out and then drown them in the fucking water
That's
of their
fucking
people.
Wild,
fucking wild.
I really love what that like the sort of like well of souls or whatever tells us or what it implies about the way these people live, because that means like for it to be that massive, those people would have had to have been there for thousands of years.
Oh, you know? For sure.
Yeah. And that's
you saw how many of them there are in that wide shot at the end, of like the fucking like you know, they go to the south, and it's just fucking million man armies
and millions.
Yeah, I mean, imagine what their pools look like. You know,
well, that big giant cave meetup that they go to, like they do a pretty good job, like establishing here's the density of the people that are in all of these shots, and then showing these giant wide fucking angles where you see these pools of light where you can count like 300 or 400 people in one pool of light, and you see seven pools of light that are like a half mile away each. Like that's a fuck ton of people just in this one massive cave, and there's people outside. Okay, there's a lot of these guys.
I needed a guy in the way back going, speak louder!
Right? That's what I'm saying. Like, everybody's fucking speak whispering, louder! And you're just like, what'd he say?
They, like, start passing the back what he's saying. He said we're going to paradise.
Who's got a pair of dice?
That sequence is really cool, though. When it Paul, like, really cool. comes all the way into his, like, dark messiah and just goes around shouting orders at people. I'd follow him in battle. I don't know.
He's like, fuck it. I'm going to lean into my fucking dirty blood.
Yeah, man. Yep.
But he really becomes a different character. Yeah, he really becomes a different character in that final quarter.
Yeah, and he starts using his family's flag and stuff. Like, that is on their battlefield.
Yeah. Yep. I love that shot when the Emperor gets his little, like, scroll.
Just
he
drops
sees the
it.
Seal, and he just fucking drops it. It's so fucking...
But Christopher Walken's best scene.
Yeah,
he doesn't say shit.
He's fucking drops.
When you leave, but I love to watch you walk away. I'm only walking down here once.
This is the Christopher Walken scene. Got it. I'm going that way. Cool.
I love this letter, but there's no cowbell attached. How am I supposed to know that it's here?
You expect me to read this?
Fun fact about like just the attention to detail in these props and stuff. That scroll. Actually was a translation, like in the fictional, you know, Dune languages or whatever. It was a translation of the passage from the novel where Paul calls out the Emperor. Like they took the time to transcribe that into the sort of like futuristic fictional language and then carve that onto that prop. And that's like, you know, those are the kind of Easter eggs that I'm grateful for. Yeah, I'm grateful for people on YouTube with eagle eyes for, you know.
Well, that's filmmaker nerds becoming filmmakers and right. then doing that shit because they fucking love it. So then other people who love it also notice it, and then they're like, three people figured it out. Fuck yes.
It's Peter Jackson's fault. Yeah. They all sat around and fucking watched that behind the scenes
shit. Oh my
shit.
God. Yes, 100%. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Our entire generation
is making chainmail in a room.
Oh man, a whole generation of filmmakers like, let's put every detail into this.
Someone will notice and care.
Lord of the Rings yes, crawled so did. Dune could hobble on the sand.
So Dune could dance walk?
Sand walk? Or, yeah,
sandworm walk.
Right, yeah, sandworm. Wait, no, wait, that's not right.
Well,
right?
According to the Hollow films that I've watched, it's actually... Sorry, never mind, you go ahead.
Bitch, I grew up here.
Oh, I believe the Hollow films. I started watching those at a young age. I believe every word. Well, the movie did have a $190 million budget.
Wasn't that like, that was like 30 more than the last one, wasn't it?
I guess. Yeah, I'm not 100% sure.
To pay for those new uniforms.
With tax incentive. I know on this one, they had a lot of COVID-19 protocols. If you look at a lot of the stills, Denis Villeneuve's either got like the chin bib, or he's actually wearing a mask. Same with the DP. And some of the Crips and technicians.
And
in the
still, they spent so much less than your average Marvel movie. Like, it's still astonishing how much they got away with.
That's not true.
No, most Marvel movies are you're thinking of Avenger 175. Movies. Yeah. Avengers movies might hit $250,000 in their budget. But.
Yeah, they'll be $300 million. Or four.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Robert Downey Jr. with your paychecks.
God damn it.
I need another boat.
I mean, the budget for the Marvels, the Captain Marvel sequel, was like 270.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why it was so lame.
Yeah, that's that's an exception to the rule.
Okay.
Yeah, that I think Eternals as well, because they had such a huge cast. But like, if you look up the budget for like Captain America, Thor, you know, I mean, some of them, again, like Captain America Civil War, you got a bunch of actors coming in. That's how those budgets go up so much.
Sure, sure.
Which is kind of crazy that they were able to pull this movie off with all the actors. And
I was about to say, yeah, this cast is not stacked, you know.
I'm sure all of them were just like, fuck yes, I want to work with you, so let's make this work however we can.
Yeah, I'm sure Chalamet got a pay cut or took a pay cut or something.
Man, I hope they got him on a three-picture deal, because if they didn't, man, like, oh, you know they paid way more for him this time.
Oh, goddamn. Blew the fuck up for sure.
Yeah.
Doesn't the next book, like, jump super far in the future? So what?
12 years, yeah.
Yeah, you're thinking of the one after this. You're
the
thinking
one after
of, yeah,
this is the you, one that goes,
yeah,
like,
Children
real
of
deep.
Dune. Yeah.
Oh, no, no. Yeah. Dune Messiah takes place 12 years after the first Dune novel.
Yeah, yeah. I'm saying the
next one.
The next one is the one where there's a bigger time jump.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then the one after that is there's like a time jump of over 1,000 years.
Wait, what?
Or at least 100. Yeah, like Paul Atreides' kids turn into like they get sandworms on them. Like, and the sandworms
they become
tiny, yeah, and baby, and they like form an armor on his son's body, and he can pretty much live forever.
What?
Yeah, they have to figure out a way to murder him.
Yeah, he
spoilers.
His
for movies that won't be made.
Yeah, no shit.
Oh, I'm sure if
wasn't
yeah.
Children of Dune, didn't that become a miniseries?
It was
2001.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's a TV series. Inside yeah. level shit.
No, it was a miniseries. It was not a TV series.
Yeah, it was a.
It was on Sci-Fi Channel.
Yeah. It's a Sci-Fi miniseries, so it yeah. at least had like budget.
It's like half commercials. Yeah,
yeah. I've seen that one.
It was like 4 hours over the three parts. Come on.
Yeah.
Of commercials, solid. Yeah.
It had William Hurt in it. Or no, wait. Maybe that was the Dune miniseries. William Hurt was in one of them, and it was pretty cool.
That was the miniseries. That was my first introduction to Dune as a concept. I saw those ones, which was pretty fantastic. So then going back and watching the 80s one was like, what the fuck is this weird shit?
I would say, I think the miniseries and, from what I remember, the miniseries and David Lynch's Dunes are both more faithful adaptations of the book.
That is what I've heard as well.
Yeah. I was surprised how far they went off from the book in this.
Does that bother you, or do you think that
I do think it benefits a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
Lynch went off into like the weirding model module? Is
oh
that
my
what it's
God,
called?
Yeah.
Yeah. Where there's
that.
That's where, like, what is it? Kyle MacLachlan does a sound. He's like, oh, yeah. And he's got this device in his hand, and it, like, projects a sound and blows
something
up. It's because
words have power, and they can use words. Yeah, so there's specific words. Yeah.
The killing word. You got to use the killing word. Abracadabra?
Avada.
It's Avada Kedavra.
I'm sorry.
Avada Kedavra.
I'm going to rewatch the Harry Potter movies this summer. I apologize.
Yeah, you got to catch up. Now then they're going to recast everybody, so you know.
Wait, what?
You get to watch it all again.
No, wait, what? No, they're not remaking those?
Warner Brothers HBO, is doing a series. Yeah.
HBO TV series for
why?
Starting over.
Why would you do that? Why? You're setting yourself up
for
failure.
Well, because this time they want to do a season for every year instead of a movie for every they already did that.
It's a Coke for a new generation.
Can you imagine if they took Star Wars or Lord of the Rings and just did an exact adaptation in a TV form of those? Oh my God, people would be so pissed.
They're getting kids on 10-year contracts and stuff.
What are the fan reactions for Harry Potter fans?
They're using the same music and like image and some like promotional images from the original films. So people are excited, but also
please don't fuck it up.
Don't ruin my childhood.
All right. Excited.
It's impossible to ruin your childhood because those movies still exist.
Correct. Thank you.
You know, that's not always true. Sometimes those sequels, like, fuck up the first movie because they'll retcon something. No. And, like, you can't unsee that motherfucker once you've seen it. You can't.
Bullshit.
No,
because
once
we get
you
David
open
Gordon
Pandora's
Grown
box,
and
you
he
can't
comes
close.
In and he makes it, those things don't exist. And then you get to, like, completely reboot. You know, there's.
No, Jared.
That's how things are done now.
No, no.
I'm with Brian on this one.
You don't close Pandora's box. Once it's open, you're fucked. We gotta burn this whole house down and start fresh.
So you're saying we should recast and then just make the movie showing us?
You can always close the box. It will be opened again.
Though. No, I mean, we need a Harry Potter parent series is what we need.
Oh, yes, fuck yeah.
Fuck yes.
That's what,
like,
we need
let's
to see.
See them as adults.
Dude. Yeah.
Yeah, the little button at the end of the season, fucking last movie.
They can be raising little baby Harry Potter. It'd be super cute. It'd be just like Baby Yoda.
Oh, no, no. Mike, what he's saying is we need fucking Lily and James Potter at school with, like, young Snape and all that.
Exactly. There we go. Prequel this shit. It'll be like Saved by the Bell with wizards. Come on.
Okay, I'm down.
And then nobody still needs a cell phone because it's still 40 years ago, so that'll be great.
And Snape will be, you know, obviously Screech, you know?
Racist?
Are we at ratings? Anybody got anything else in their notes? I guess I didn't.
Man, there's so much in this fucking movie.
Yeah,
what
for
are you
real.
Saying, Brian?
I was going to say, I guess we didn't. Did we mention this was the biggest hit of the year so far?
Didn't it, like, outgross the first one in the first, like, month or less or something like that?
Yeah, it may have been like the second or third weekend, because that one only made like 100 million. I mean, it was what was it, it was 2021. It had a day
release.
Release
on HBO at the same time.
Exactly,
that's right.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I only saw the first Dune in theaters twice, and then I saw it like four times on HBO Max in a month.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think this one is even more rewatchable than the first one.
All right, you're gonna say that, but I saw this in the theater once.
I saw it three times.
Once.
Yeah.
And since it came out on disc, I've seen it twice. So I've done a whopping three times. Hasn't even hit the first 3 weeks of the first Dune. First 3 weeks of release, I should say.
What made the first one more rewatchable for you, Brian?
Man, it feels fresh. I think the first installment feels fresh. Like, okay, again, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, like, this is unfair. Like, I was talking to Jared earlier this week, and I was like, you know, I really understand now what Star Wars fans felt. You know, like the ones that were in between the ages of 10 to 20 that saw that first movie, and that was the first Star Wars they ever saw, and then they got Empire Strikes Back, you know? And
yeah.
In my modern eyes, and like how I grew up, you know, like being born 2 years after that movie came out, you know, I'm like, are you fucking idiots? How can you not see Empire Strikes Back? It's clearly the better movie. I mean, it's great. But, I mean, I kind of get what they're saying now here with, like, Dune. Like, I got so sci-fi fucking high off the first one. When I go back for the second one, I'm like, this sci-fi... The spice ain't doing it for me anymore, man. I'm not getting this high anymore. I've done it too much. I need more. I need some really potent shit. You got any fucking Colombian spice or something? I don't know, man. I need some good shit. You know what I mean? And, like, that's not fair to Dune Part 2. Like, to be like, look, you're not living up to the expectations that were set out with one. But, like, there is never a moment in this movie that feels like when Jason Momoa is running away from that fucking laser, yeah, you know, and you're seeing that laser cut through all of those fucking buildings, and the building edges are fucking falling off, and it's right behind him. And then the soundtrack's doing that little, and you're like, what the fuck is this? This isn't hero music. And it just fits. It all fits. And you're like, this is weird. This is bizarre.
Just building odd tone. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And this is like a blockbuster I haven't seen before. And when I went to Dune Part 2, it's like, no, this feels like a very Spielberg blockbuster. I get all the Spielberg reaction shots. I'm getting all the normal movie making cliches. Let me back that up. I'm getting all the normal movie making extravaganza
devices
and spectacle. Yeah, right.
Sure.
But
yeah.
I'm not getting that weirdness. I'm not getting the, like, oh, this is so bizarre. Except for like those three moments that we've called out before. That's why that guy. That's why everybody, when you read the reviews, they were all talking about the gladiator scene. It's because it's so fucking bizarre. It's so fucking weird.
You want more bizarre, more weird.
Especially when those weird creatures with the hooks that come out. You know, well, I know they're people dressed up, but they click like.
Yeah, you know? Or like the, yeah. I kept calling them like half crescent moon heads. They reminded me like something out of Silent Hill.
Yeah, very yeah. Silent Hill.
I see your point. I really connect with that too. I don't think it hurt my ability to like watch it a bunch of times and still like feel as engaged as the first one, but it really is much more conventional and in some ways sort of expected than the first one was. Yeah.
I like Denis Villeneuve the best when he's putting us in situations that we completely understand. And like we've all experienced these moments in movies before, and he throws it off. The border crossing in Sicario is a great example. We've all seen that action scene, but we never seen it like that. The introduction to the alien spaceship in Arrival. You know, we've all been into a spaceship. We never seen it like that. You know, that's what makes Denis Villeneuve so great. I want to make love with an AI robot in like Blade Runner 2049. Mm. How do we do that? It's great. It's great. It's just, it's not what I expected from this director. You know, it's the same thing like I felt after getting done with The Dark Knight Rises. You know, it's like same director, Christopher Nolan. I love The Dark Knight so much. And I get out of that movie and I'm like, it's great. I love it. It's a good Batman movie, but goddamn, it doesn't hit the heights. It doesn't. And is that the movie's fault? No.
Yeah, I read a review where some guy was like comparing it to Alien and Aliens, where like he's saying that this film is like two different genres, kind of like how they did there.
Yeah.
This one has the action that the first one promised us that it only delivered in dream sequences. This one is like, oh, you guys wanted all that. Like,
no,
now,
come
now
on.
Do some of that.
the destruction of the House Atreides is like fucking amazing and heartbreaking.
Yeah, but that's like 10 minutes as opposed to
it's
the final
the last fucking goddamn 40 minutes of that movie. Like, then they go on run and they're being chased by the Sardaukar, whatever they call it.
Sardaukar,
yeah.
Yeah, fucking, come on. No. That whole like last 40 minutes is an action scene.
Yeah, this one is structured rather differently. Like the first 48 minutes or so is we're with Paul, we're with the Fremen, we're like discovering what the Fremen are living like, we're figuring out where we're going to go, what they're going to do. And then like it kind of hard cuts and we jump into the Harkonnen world and it's like, all right, here's everything else that's happening in the galaxy. And like, I don't know, I watched that first 48 minutes last night. Just like I was gotta watch it again before we do the thing. And it felt like such a great moment to pause because I had to go to bed because I have shit going on in my life. But I was like, this was a relatively like solid, complete story just kind of in that first like act one of this movie. And then like jumping to the next part, like it's the appropriate time. We've seen enough. It's time to move on to the something else. And but like I think the way that this movie is structured in those major sections, it's a very different structure than the last one because we're not trying to introduce the world. We're not trying to tell you how the universe works. We're like, now we're getting in with these people. That's, I think, also why we talked about most character introductions are close-ups because we've seen the world. We've established what the universe is. Now let's get on the intimate level with these fucking people. And sometimes there's big spectacle and big scope. And so that's why you start close and then go wide as opposed to starting wide and then going close. So just a really interesting approach on an like a intellectual level in this movie.
And that level of intentionality is what I expected Denis to bring to this. That sort of like understanding the process of what order you establish the essential parts of the story and then where do you go from one to the next and how. I loved this one thing he said. He talked about how he like storyboarded the majority of the movie and then actually went back and rewrote the script to match his storyboards.
Oh, I could totally see that. Yeah.
And that's sort of why I think that Denis is, you know, perfect for this, because he's so visual and he understands how to actually compose a movie as opposed to just like, getting coverage, doing compositions as opposed to just getting coverage.
Yeah, there's not a lot. Well, I was going to say there's not a lot of coverage. There's a lot of small two-hander conversation scenes that is just coverage, but most of the things in between those, there's not a lot of like, well, let's shoot coverage of these 15 people in the shots. Like he knows where he wants to go. He knows where he wants to be. And then the intimate moments of relationship building, especially between Chani and Paul, that's where you see some of the more standard filmmaking levels of things. But
yeah. And Brian, I'm sure you could speak to this, but the edit feels very tight and intentional. I like can't think of a moment where we're like cutting to something that doesn't immediately further the story or tell me some new piece of information.
All right. So I'm a big fan of Joe Walker. I think he is a fantastic editor. I think he works really good with Denis Villeneuve. This felt the most Michael Caine cut movie of all time. And if you guys don't know who that is, that's Spielberg's editor. It felt too short, man, for me. Like, I needed
2 hours and 45 minutes felt too short.
Yeah. They're putting in too much story. I needed some of these shots to hang longer, and then some of this other superfluous stuff to be cut. I don't know.
What can you think of any specific examples of like the superfluous stuff?
Like, I don't need to see them burning birds. You know,
right? Yeah, and, like, we got one shot, cool, got it, and then we're sitting there for four more shots.
Yeah, I got one shot.
Now there's a close up. One falls on the ground. Like, okay, we got it.
Yeah, I got one shot of the birds in their little fucking nest in the circular room before they got burned. And you know, my first watch, I didn't even register it.
Yeah, you don't.
Yeah, it wasn't until I think I watched it the third time that I was like, "Oh shit!" They show you the birds before they, you know, because it's just so quick. Your brain can only process so much detail and so much information. You know, that's why people go back and rewatch movies, obviously. So I don't know. Again, that's why I wish we just slowed down like the first movie a little bit. I need some more wide. I need to go in close and then come back out wide. I don't know. Maybe it's great. Maybe this is Empire Strikes Back and it's just different and I'm not used to it. Like, you know what I mean? I'm not saying it's bad. It's just not the same.
So as of right now, you would say you prefer the first one.
But maybe I'm an idiot. Who knows, man? We're arguing over different variations of goodness and greatness. You know what I mean? Like, what are we talking about, really?
Yeah, like, which kind of tone is more in your vibe right now that you're looking for? Like, you know, maybe I was just in the right mood at the right time when the first one came out. And I was like, fuck yes, this is everything I wanted it to be. I don't know. I will say on this one, there were like six different moments where I was just sitting. I didn't see it in the theater. I feel like a fucking piece of shit. I was sitting on the couch watching this. I at least have Atmos surround sound in my house. Like, I watched it properly. Like, don't get off my ass. But there were six different moments where I was just like, holy shit. What is fucking happening right now? Like, that is the coolest thing I've ever seen. What the fuck? There was a lot of really, really great moments in this fucking movie. And I enjoyed on a more consistent basis the first one, but the fucking highs of this movie are so high that I feel like if I rewatch both of them like back to back, like next year or something like that, I feel like I'm going to like the second one better. That's where I'm
at. I think you should
right
just
now.
Stitch them together and make one big movie.
No, that's when they watch them, do the Godfather saga. It's not Godfather part 1 and 2. It's the Godfather saga.
It's just Dune. But like when they bring back Josh Brolin's character and they've got those fucking mines that are buried under the fucking sand and they, those are cool. And they like stick to the hole. This is so fucking badass.
I fucking hated those until Josh Brolin shot one of them. And then I was like,
that's the coolest fucking thing ever.
Never mind.
Yes.
He's so real for that.
He's such a badass. Yeah.
He's perfectly cast.
Agreed.
That character. Yeah.
Dude, him and Javier. They're both excellent in their roles. Yes.
I definitely think that this movie makes the first one better also. Like, I think when we look back on, you know, when we're on this mountaintop looking out on other peaks, I think this movie actually like improves the first one because it gives us levels of symmetry. Like, I love that this movie ends in a ceremonial knife fight, but in a completely different cultural context. You know, there's no music. In the first one, you know, Paul basically sacrifices Jamis, you know, kills a guy to find himself. And then in the second one, he, you know, gives himself up in a sense. He loses himself to kill his enemy. There's like a poetry to that, what he's doing in both of those combat scenes that I think, like, in retrospect, makes the first scene the first fight with Jamis hit even harder and makes it more enjoyable. So,
all right. Are we at ratings?
Unless we're gonna nerd out about fucking camera shit and how every single goddamn shot of this desert is like perfectly color balanced and how all the color tones are so great.
Okay, all right, you brought up color tones. I got, man.
Let's do it. Let's talk.
Have you guys seen the fucking raw behind the scene footage of this shit?
No, I would love to see. What that looks like.
Oh my god! All right, first off, I didn't know how many goddamn vignettes they put on fucking every shot and how fucking red. They just put so much goddamn red in this fucking in the color correction. the sand is like gold. When you watch this movie, the sand is dark red. In fact, the sky is red.
Not in every shot. Not in every shot. But
the,
and that's one of the things
the
I love about this movie.
Is like going down. Then it turns gold.
Then it gets really yellow.
It depends on where the sun is, and it depends on how much dust is in the air. Because like later with the Emperor fight scene, like when they're in that throne room, everything is cool tones and like kind of daylight-ish sort of feels. And then as soon as like shit blows up outside, like everything turns orange as soon as there's dust in the air. You know what I'm saying? Like, so they play with some things like that, but also like. There's a few times where they're outside and everything goes a little bit bleach bypassed where like all the highlight saturation is just super low and it's a little bit more contrasty. But then there's so many moments where they're like, oh, it's dusk or it's, you know, the storm's coming. And like there's a consistent color tone throughout the movie, but like it's varying degrees of what is the sun doing? How diffused is the sun? Is there dust in the air? Is there not? Is it straight, harsh sunlight? Are we trying to make it feel hot? I think they're... I fucking love it, man. Greg Fraser's doing so much work, and it all works really consistently from scene to scene. And especially with all the moments where stuff changes in the middle of the scene, when they want to flip the color just to make the next part of it feel like it's different because we've been in that same room for too long or something. Like, they build that thing in.
You're talking about that scene like with the dust from the big atomic explosion and the sandworms coming in, right?
Yep.
You know how that looked? This is my problem with that movie. That image never looks as cool as the fucking palm trees burning at the end of Dune Part 1. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There is not a single fucking goddamn iconic image like that.
The three giant sandworms flying out of the, you know, diving out of the sand and into the starter car didn't do it for you like that?
No, it doesn't because, like...
It's in the trailer.
Yeah, well...
Do you think that they did that... I'm trying to see here on IMDb. It doesn't look like it, but in the first movie, they shot digitally and then captured on film and then went back to digital for edit. I don't think they did that.
I didn't see any fucking any film intermediates whatsoever. I only saw printed film on 70 millimeter.
70 mil.
Yeah.
Kodak Vision 2383.
Yeah.
So that's maybe why it has a little bit of a different look too. They didn't do all the crazy shit like they did in the first one.
Well, also they had time in between the movies to like figure out how they wanted to change how they're going to work and stuff.
2 years.
Yeah, but like they weren't Peter Jacksoning it. They weren't shooting both movies concurrently. It wasn't a 400-day shoot. Like he had time to post the first one and then start the second
and
one.
Mike,
you know what I'm saying?
Is that why Lord of the Rings is maybe best fucking goddamn trilogy outside of maybe the first Star Wars? I mean, come on, like for real, like maybe that's why Lord of the Rings trilogy is so special, is because
they're just in it and they're in it the whole time for all three fucking movies.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Like maybe
7 fucking years, bro, just living it.
I mean, there's a lot to be said for that. Like you get up every day and you frame a shot, and that's what you do that day, and then you go home and you go to sleep, and then you get up the next day and you frame more shots. And
you know, when I put in the Two Towers, I don't go, hey, this guy's wearing a different costume. Never, ever. That never, never. Like, in terms of, like, nerd enjoyment, oh, perfection.
That's a fair point. All right, yeah, you kind of talked me into that. Interesting.
I do feel like we're at ratings now. Who's going first? Who is rating Dune Part 2?
I'm a little out of it, so I'm going to go. Obviously, this is a fucking 10 because it's a Denis Villeneuve movie. It instantly becomes that.
You don't have to say that just fucking, for me, Jared.
Oh, no. I didn't know who he was until I met you. And then I have grown to love this man. He's top tier filmmaker right now. Like, he's up there with fucking Christopher Nolan.
Oh, he's it's one him of my and Christopher. Favorites. Absolutely.
Him and Christopher Nolan are killing the game. Visually, fucking the crazy fucking score, the top-notch fucking special effects, all of it just fucking lands. I mean, like we're saying, we're nitpicking a fucking modern masterpiece. You can't say it's not a 10 because we rate way less films 10, so this one's obviously a 10.
Wait, but you, yeah, man, not it, we.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. I have a big heart.
and I like to throw out big numbers, but let's so this one then is an 11.
All right, we got wait. You can't go 11.
It's go to 11. Yeah,
right. No. These pods don't go past 10.
All right, we got a 10 from Jared. Who's going next?
Man, like, this movie's fucking epic on just a perfect scale. Like, there were so many Lawrence of Arabia level epic moments in this movie that were just, I loved it. I loved the whole thing, man. There's a lot of, like, Blade Runner, like, Greg Fraser's kind of channeling some Deakins in some moments, but then like there are other moments where I'm just like, there's fucking Batman. Greg Fraser, just do your work. Fuck, man. This movie is craftsmanship at such a masterful level that I could watch it probably, 15 more times and still see new things every single time. This movie is so good that we spent an hour and a half talking about minutia. That kind of didn't work because the whole of the movie is so fucking perfectly executed. That is the dream. That's what the whole fucking game is about. Make something that captures people's attention, that captures people's emotions, takes us on a journey, and is fucking spectacular along the way. I saw so much shit in this movie that I've never seen before that just blew me away. From camera angles to like ways that they were framing things to characters that they're putting in these massive frames with the perspectives that it's just the movie's fucking perfect, man. I don't know what else to say. It's a goddamn 10.
Preach.
Oh, two tens. Jacob, as the guest, you want to go next or you want to go last?
Oh, I'll go next. I'm going to have to really stand out here and call it a 10. This movie isn't just... it's not just a really strong movie. It's something that feels... culturally relevant to a degree. Like this feels like the kind of masterpiece that we're going to be looking back 10, 15, 20 years from now going like, yeah, I remember seeing Dune in theaters, it's not only a masterclass in each individual part. It's not just a masterclass in sound. It's not just a masterclass in cinematography, in, that sort of, rhythmic, poetic storytelling and writing. It's a masterclass in bringing all of those things together into one grand experience. And, Villeneuve's the guy to do that. He's sort of proven himself to be the guy to do that when we're dealing with science fiction and beyond. I mean, this man can take a grand space epic like Dune. He can take, a really strong drama like Arrival. And he can make the material more... than your run-of-the-mill average studio director could. And I think that's something that not only resonates with a lot of people, but is like needed in the industry right now. I think that there's a reason why Dune made so much money. I think there's a reason why Dune made so much money in the IMAX. And I love it for those reasons and more. As a big Dune fan, I'm really happy. I think all the deviations from the novel are deviations that make the story stronger and make the film stronger and make it more accessible. So just about every metric I could judge it, it comes across as a 10. I'm definitely going to call it perfect, if not damn near, or just about as good as I could have hoped for.
And it is one of those movies that you definitely missed out if you didn't see it on the big screen.
Fuck you.
It lends itself to epicness.
Yeah, yeah.
Only because the aspect ratio doesn't expand for those films, scenes.
I was waiting for it.
That they shot in IMAX.
It didn't happen.
Or
I was sad about
the
that.
The scenes that they shot on the 65? They shoot it in the 65?
The 65 and the LF Mini were their two cameras.
For this one?
Yes.
I thought they shot this whole thing on IMAX.
On IMAX film cameras? No, hell no.
No.
Yeah,
even you can tell by the grain. It was the same cameras.
Yeah, this is digital. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't have that Nolan look. I mean,
65 is IMAX. It's 65 millimeter film.
That's an acquisition format, 70 is
and then it exhibition. Gets blown up
Thank
to
you,
70
Greeks.
Millimeter.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So the digital 65 is still IMAX.
Jared, what's the Rotten Tomatoes score for Dune?
Dune comes in with a 92% tomato meter, Brian, with a 95% audience score.
That's fucking high.
Yeah,
really
good.
High.
It's good. It's a good flick. You can catch me on Instagram at Check the Gate.
Didn't get me as high as the first movie. So with that, you've been listening to the Movie Crew Podcast. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so by following us on Instagram, Twitter, X, whatever, and Facebook at Movie Crew Pod. You can send us an email at moviecrewpod@gmail.com. Jared, where can they follow you?
On Instagram at Check the Gate.
Griggs, where can they follow you?
I'm on Instagram at Griggsy Media. That's G-R-I-G-G-S-Y Media.
And Jacob, do you have anywhere our audience can find you or see some of your work, sir?
Yeah. You can find me on Instagram at Afterlife Jacob. That's A-F-T-R-L-F-E Jacob. And thanks for having me on the pod, guys. I appreciate you all letting me join because I love this movie so much.
You guys can find me on Twitter at Elkins Edits. And we're going to close out the show tonight with an excerpt from the score. We're going to be playing... I don't know. Does anybody have a favorite track?
The love theme. They're... Paul and Chani's love theme. I believe it's the first track.
So we're going to be playing track number one from the Dune Part 2 soundtrack titled Beginnings Are Such Delicate Times. This is from composer Hans Zimmer. Enjoy.
Power over spice is power over all. And spice is worm poop.